A meeting of the House Special Committee on Energy will come to order. It is now 3:02 p.m. Tuesday, April 5, 2011. It's day 78 here in the Ramona Barnes Committee Room of the Capitol. We're in room 124. Members present to my right, we have Representative Peterson, Representative Sadler, Representative Pruitt, Representative Foster, Representative Olson, Representative Lynn, and Representative Tuck. Let the record reflect that we have a quorum to conduct business. Please turn off your smartphones and cell phones because they will disrupt our sound and recording systems. So today we'll be hearing House Concurrent Resolution 10 that encourages waste to energy technology by Representative Pete Peterson, and an update on energy efficiency policy by Dr. John Davies. And he's with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. So first, HCR 10, we have before us a draft committee substitute version B, which makes a minor change to the original resolution. Before we hear from the sponsor, the chair would entertain a motion to adopt the draft committee substitute. We need a vehicle on which to work, and therefore the chair would welcome a motion to adopt committee substitute for HCR 10 version B.
Mr. Chair, I adopt
for discussion
mm-hmm. the committee substitute on HCR 10 version B.
Thank you. Now, before we hear from Representative Peterson, I'd like to note that we have Ted Michaels of the Energy Recovery Council on teleconference to describe waste to energy technology, and we'll hear from him after Representative Peterson describes his resolution and tells us how version B differs from his original measure. So with that, Representative Peterson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman, and members of the Energy Committee. Thank you for taking the time to hear this resolution today. House Concurrent Resolution 10 encourages the state, municipalities, and private sector organizations to consider the benefits and costs of waste-to-energy technology. Waste-to-energy is an exciting technology that turns garbage into electricity while reducing the amount of landfill space needed. Waste to energy is a renewable energy source which generates between 500 to 600 kilowatt hours for every ton of garbage burned. Waste to energy technology is being used around the world and at least 24 states. According to the Energy Recovery Council, there are at least 86 waste-to-energy plants in the United States. This technology is being utilized at Eielson Air Force Base in Alaska, where garbage is burned along with coal. And in Anchorage, we are in the process of building a generator to harness the methane created by the Anchorage landfill. There are several different ways of creating energy from garbage. The waste can be burned directly, or it can be processed into other combustible substances like ethanol or biodiesel. Waste-to-energy plants are being used to provide power for major urban areas in the U.S. and Europe, and in smaller areas like Ames, Iowa. There are also much smaller waste-to-energy generators being developed and tested. For example, one company has developed a generator about the size of a large dumpster, which produces 120 kilowatt hours of electricity. The U.S. Army has been testing a similar size generator in Iraq to provide an alternative energy source for military operations. Now, I know that committee members are well aware of the energy needs facing communities across the state, and the goal of the legislature adopted last year was to generate 50% of our electricity from renewable energy sources by 2025. Throughout the process of adopting the statewide energy policy last year, HB 306, there was strong support for taking a diversified approach to meeting our energy needs. Waste energy technology has been shown to produce fewer emissions than would be created by dumping the garbage in the landfill. And the EPA has determined that waste to energy has less environmental impact than almost any other source of electricity. Another benefit of waste to energy technology is that with the use of magnetic sorting after combustion, American waste energy plants recover over 770,000 tons of recyclable scrap metal that would otherwise have just been dumped into a landfill, and that's every single year. Waste energy has the potential to be a piece of our statewide energy puzzle, and I encourage the committee to support this resolution to encourage the state, municipalities, and private sector organizations to consider the costs and benefits of waste-to-energy technology. And as far as the changes to this version of the bill, it is simply that originally we had mentioned it wasn't Eielson Air Force Base in Fairbanks where they were using it. We had mentioned the other base in Fairbanks, and so we corrected that when that information was brought forward to us. That's the only change between this version of the resolution and the previous version.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. And we've got a question from Representative Bob Lynn.
Yeah. What's the effect of waste energy on air pollution, fumes, you know, and so on?
Representative Lynn, through the chair, actually there is less pollution than if you just dumped it into a landfill and let the methane seep up out of the ground. The incinerators are built to take out the bad chemicals that would otherwise be going out in the form of smoke, and so usually the only thing that is emitted is steam. So the pollution, the EPA has rated this form of energy production as the most efficient, or one of the most efficient and non-polluting forms of electricity generation.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Through the chair, for the record, I'm David Dunsmore, staff representative Peterson. I just wanted to point out in the bill packet, there's a copy of a 2007 memo from the EPA that details the emissions data that the representative was just discussing.
Thank you. Is Ted Michaels still online there?
I am here.
Oh, thank you, Ted. And if it sounds like you'd like to testify, if you could just state your name and affiliation for the record, please.
I'd be happy to. My name is Ted Michaels, and I am president of the Energy Recovery Council.
Thank you. And please proceed if you have a testimony.
Well, thank you very much. I think that Representative Peterson did an exemplary job of outlining all of the major benefits of waste energy, and I really wanted to take this opportunity to commend him for his leadership on this issue. I think it's incredibly important that in all of the states across America that we are looking at as many ways of generating electricity as possible, and that municipal solid waste or household trash is an abundant source that affects every community across America, and communities all across America are grappling with how to manage this. And frankly, once you reduce, reuse, and recycle as much as you can, there's only two options. It is you can send the waste to a waste energy facility, or you can send that waste to a landfill. And the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency says that waste energy is preferable to landfilling, and we agree with that. So the Energy Recovery Council fully supports Representative Peterson's resolution encouraging the state and municipalities and universities to and private organizations to weigh the benefits. We certainly would like them to pursue waste energy to the extent it makes sense for their community. One of the things that another member of the committee just asked about with the emissions, and Representative Peterson touched on it, is that the emissions are fully compliant with the most stringent EPA regulations that they have, called Maximum Achievable Control Technology Standards under the Clean Air Act. We've been compliant with those since the late 90s. Well, I should say the regulations came out in the late 90s, and we were immediately compliant with them after communities and companies across America spent about $1 billion in retrofits. And of course, any new facility would be fully compliant with those technology standards immediately. it is also compatible with recycling. Oftentimes you may hear that if you have a waste energy plant, then the community doesn't have to recycle that much. And in fact, across America, we see in the exact opposite is true, that communities with waste energy are more sophisticated with respect to recycling and have higher recycling rates than the communities that don't have waste energy. Is a waste energy plant fully responsible for that? No, not fully. If a community has taken the time to analyze all of its options and they're most likely have a sophisticated solid waste plant, they're going to have a sophisticated recycling program. Representative Peterson did ably note that waste energy facilities are able to recover metals out of the trash that, frankly, can't be recycled in the bin that you put on your curb. If it goes to a landfill, they get no energy from it. And it accounts for roughly 2-3% of the waste stream, the volume of the waste stream coming in. So that's a considerable amount of recycling that will occur because of waste energy. So I wanted to, I'd be happy to answer any questions, and I don't want to take more time than I need. I appreciate the opportunity to testify. We fully support passage of this resolution, and we look forward to working further to implement further policies in Alaska that would move waste energy to a place of acceptance and implementation. I'd be happy to answer any questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. We have a question from Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Michaels, forgive my ignorance on this one. Can you tell me what the Energy Recovery Council is and the membership, what it's organized to?
I'd be happy to. I apologize for not having expounded on that at the beginning. The Energy Recovery Council is the national trade association representing the waste energy sector. It's made up of companies and communities that own and operate or are otherwise engaged in the waste energy business. So our major members are Covanta Energy and Wheelabrator Technologies, which own and operate combined about 57 waste energy plants in the United States. We have about 28 local governments that own or operate waste energy facilities across the United States. We also include companies and organizations that are otherwise interested in seeing waste energy expanded across the United States. So we provide educational, technical, research, and advocacy services for our members.
Okay, so you represent the users, the advocates, and sellers of this technology.
That's true. Yes, sir.
Good, thank you.
Are there further questions, Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Can you help me understand? I'm seeing here that there's different locations that have units that exist. I guess I'm still not 100% sure on exactly what constitutes a unit, but I guess really where my question comes from is, what is the typical cost and the return that can be expected on a unit in an individual location?
That's a difficult question to answer, if only because every place in the country, the costs are a little bit different. The costs of doing business are a little bit different. The size of the facility also, has obviously a great deal to do with the cost and the economies of scale. For instance, there's a plant in Florida. Give you a sticker shot, but there's a facility in Florida, one of the largest in the country, proposed to be one of the largest in the country, processing about 3,000 tons of trash every day, and they're looking at somewhere in the neighborhood of $650 to $700 million. There are obviously waste energy solutions that are being developed today on a smaller scale, scales that are much more likely to be advantageous in Alaska. I couldn't give you a quote on what one of those would cost. It would largely, generally these are bid out, and it's fairly competitive. and everybody has a different price for sometimes the same exact thing. So I'm unable to give you a direct price other than that, you know, I will say that these are, you know, significant capital investment because they are, in essence, sophisticated power plants with the top-end emission control equipment, and, you know, compared to a landfill. And whereas, you know, a landfill is certainly more sophisticated than they were 25 years ago, it is still not exactly a power plant, if you will. So that's the struggle that Waste Energy has had across the country, is having to compete with landfills, which have much lower capital costs, and you know, putting in place policies such as renewable energy policies that will allow us to recoup, say, a little more revenue through our electricity revenue stream, makes it more affordable for the communities to dispose of the waste, and that makes us more competitive with landfilling.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you. Are there further questions of the committee? Representative Peterson?
I was just going to say that my aide, David Dunsmore, has some information about a plant that was built a few years ago in Virginia, I believe it was.
Yes, I've gotten, Mr. Chairman, David Dunsmore, staff to Representative Peterson. We were trying to find some more specific cost estimate, and as Mr. Michael said, you know, this is every plant is unique, and there's various different ways of creating them, so there isn't the one thing. But we were able to find some numbers. One is a plant in Fairfax County, Virginia, and these are the numbers for. Couldn't find the numbers for what the generation cost, but we found the numbers for what they were selling the electricity for. And in 2002, it was 1.72 cents per kilowatt hour, and by 2009, that had increased to 3.3 cents per kilowatt hour. And also, the Department of Energy compiles estimates for the costs of just average costs for different types of power plants. They don't classify waste energy separately, so it would fall under the biomass category. But I can just briefly go over some of those numbers. They estimate that biomass, the total system levelized cost for a biomass power plant is $112.5 per megawatt hour. And for comparison, the hydroelectric is $86.4 per megawatt hour. Conventional combustion turbine natural gas plants are $124.5. Conventional coal is $94.8. Advanced coal with a carbon capture systems is $136.2.
Did you say that a gas turbine was 124 or 24.5?
This was for a conventional combustion turbine, natural gas fired. It would be 124.5. And then these numbers are based on the estimated average costs for a power plant in these categories coming online in 2016. And then to make it more confusing, they're using $2009 dollars for estimates for 2016. But. And I to clarify with the national, that was for the conventional combustion turbine thing. There are the advanced combined cycle natural gas fire plant would be estimated at 63.1.
Representative Peterson?
So, Mr. Chairman, it's depending on how big a plant, depending on what your investment is and how much garbage you have, there's a sliding scale on what the costs are. But the cost of producing electricity is competitive with with other forms of electricity generating materials.
Further questions, Representative Sadler?
Okay, I'm going to thank you, Mr. Chairman. David, and I'm going to reveal my ignorance of the metric system. I should have paid more attention in ninth grade, but if it's $112 per megawatt hour, how does that translate to kilowatt hour?
I believe you divide that by 1,000.
So we're looking at like 11.125 cents per kilowatt hour from biomass?
Yes, I believe so.
Perfect.
Again, my math skills are not much to brag about.
You're correct. That's the way it is.
Good deal. Thank you, Mr. Richards, or Michaels.
Further questions of the committee?
One other question.
Representative Pruitt?
I think most of what we're specifying here is we're talking about the incineration. Where do we get the energy to incinerate it? And how much is that? Are we using natural gas? Are we using methane from the landfill itself? Are we using electricity? Where is that coming from? And how much is that?
I'd be happy to answer that if you like.
Go ahead, Ted Michaels.
The waste itself is there's a requirement to start up the unit when you come out of a maintenance period or when you're starting from scratch. You will most of the facilities either use a fuel like a diesel fuel oil or some natural gas, but you only use that to get the first ton of waste to ignite, if you will. And once the waste is catches fire, if you will, the it's self-perpetuating. The waste feeds itself. There's no other supplemental energy requirements through the process until you actually turn it off and go into a shutdown mode, and then you use some supplemental fuel to make sure that you've got complete combustion of the last ton of trash, because complete combustion is a good engineering practice for emissions control. So it does not require any natural gas to maintain the fire as it goes. That is self-sustaining. So the actual cost of that supplemental fuel is very minimal, because it only happens when you come in and out of a maintenance period, which is not very often.
Representative Pruitt?
And that holds true for environments that are colder like ours is? Do we have, is there any special consideration that needs to be taken into the fact that we can come across times where it's significantly colder, we're below zero for periods of time?
I'm not aware that would cause a problem inside the furnace. The only thing that I would say could potentially be an issue is if the cold up there caused the waste to be to have a significantly higher moisture content than the rest of the country. The wetter the trash, the less hot it burns, for example. So if you had significantly, this is, for instance, in Florida in the spring with a lot of wet grass clippings, it's very hard to burn. At that point, I could envision a situation in which they may need to just get it a little bit hotter, but that is incredibly uncommon. And I would without speaking from a position of technological authority on that matter, not having experience in Alaska, I would say that it would have more to do with the composition of the trash than the temperatures outside.
Thank you.
Okay. Are there further questions of the committee? One of the questions that I had. How does this affect, for example, AEA, municipalities, private organizations that are listed? Has that, I guess, how much interface have you had with those folks? And have they come out overwhelming support? I'm just always concerned about unforeseen consequences.
Well, Mr. Chairman, this is Representative Peterson again. This is considered a form of renewable energy or alternative energy, either one, depending on how you want to look at it. And so it would go towards reaching our goal of the 50% by 2025 of renewable energy. And it would also keep the size of our landfills from increasing so fast, and in many instances getting full to where you have to build and develop new landfills and drive the garbage even further away. So you end up spending more money on transportation of the garbage from where the pickup points are. Because when I first moved to Anchorage 30 years ago, they were dumping the garbage at just offside of Merrill Field, and now they're having to drive it 15 miles out to Eagle River. And so you can imagine how many gallons of diesel fuel they're burning every year to haul that garbage the extra 15 miles out and then drive the truck empty back another 15 miles into Anchorage. So there could, by not having to keep building the landfills further out, you reduce the cost of fuel and of the entire waste operation.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, for the end of the record, David Dunsmore, staff to Representative Peterson. I mean, when we were drafting this resolution, we're trying to be as conscious as possible of, you know, not having creating unintended consequences, and of the discussions last year with the stakeholders and the whole process of coming up with the energy policy was, I mean, I think it's, you know, my perspective in the back, sitting in the back as a staffer watching everything, I think everyone was unanimous about wanting to explore new ideas and be for Alaska, but also that we weren't going to, you know, that it wasn't a good idea to have a one-size-fit-all approach, or to, you know, put mandates on communities or organizations that don't work for their needs. And so in drafting this resolution, we tried to, you know, make sure we have a way to, you know, try to raise awareness about the potential for this new technology. But it's still up to any individual community to decide what, you know, whether the costs or the benefits work for them, and to make their own decision. And also, this wouldn't, you know, the factors involved with the Renewable Energy Fund and the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, this wouldn't in any way affect the factors that they determine, that they go through the professional analysis about handing out grants. So, I mean, they would, you know, any, you know, those processes would be totally unaffected and would be totally based off of the standards that the AEA staff has put together for those programs.
Representative Sadler?
I got a question. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Not sure who's the best person to answer it, but what's the minimum size of one of these kind of units, and what's the maximum size? It sounds like we heard the nation's largest one is being proposed in Florida. What's the smallest size this unit can be and still be effective? I'm just trying to think how it might be scaled for use in Alaska communities.
I'd be happy to answer that. This is Ted Michaels with the Energy Recovery Council. You're right, the largest facility in the country is about 3,000 tons per day of municipal solid waste. Right now, the smallest units, I'd say, are about 75 tons per day. And those are, there's a couple of those located in Minnesota. They can be scaled. There are certainly companies that would be willing to create, you know, modular units that can be scaled to meet the particular needs of the community. I would say, you know, there's some point where you lose the economy of scale, where it's technically feasible, but it wouldn't be economically advisable. But I would think that if you could had enough waste to operate 80 tons per day, then there's certainly precedent for that in the United States today.
Okay. Follow up, good.
Representative Sadler.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. This is a kind of a slightly different tack. I'm going to ask you to kind of play the devil's advocate for me, because I think you're the expert in the room or in the cloud here about this technology. We've heard some information about the benefits of the technology. What's the cons? What's the downside of this technology other than the cost?
I was going to say it is more expensive than landfilling. I mean, that's typically that is over time. We've seen the cost of landfilling go up. Representative Peterson mentioned that the cost of driving the garbage keeps going up, and both in terms of environmental costs and fuel costs. I was actually Representative Peterson talked about 15 miles away to bring your trash to a landfill. And we have cases on the East Coast here where in Massachusetts they have 7 waste energy facilities, but there's that only handles about half of the state's waste. Some of the other waste gets on a train and goes to South Carolina. Now, you can imagine how far that is. That's got to be 800 to 1,000 miles of driving your trash to a landfill. So we've always had difficulty competing with that. The other issue is that it does require some landfilling to run a waste energy plant. So when you combust 1 ton of trash, there's going to be a 90% reduction of the volume of the trash. So if you were to run 100 cubic yards of trash to a waste energy plant, you're going to be left over with 10 cubic yards of ash that needs to go into a landfill. We've yet to be able to find a beneficial reuse that's been acceptable to environmental agencies for that kind of material. So that will have to go into a landfill setting, although sometimes it can be used as alternative daily cover at a landfill rather than using fresh, clean dirt. And there is an expense to that, and that's one of, that's one of the operations and maintenance expenses that make waste energy a little more expensive than we would like it.
Okay. And a follow-up comment, if I may. My community of Eagle River considers it's actually about 10 miles away from between Eagle River and South Eagle River down the lower end. And certainly we do have lots of land in Alaska. A friend down south says Alaska has miles and miles of miles and miles, so we're not running out of land, I would observe. But thanks.
Representative Pruitt?
Yeah, I just had one question based on something that he said. You said something about landfill sod or something. What all can be incinerated? Can everything be incinerated, or is there certain things that have to be sorted out?
Well, there's certainly restrictions in the permit of what goes into the trash. We are not permitted to take medical waste. There can be nothing in there that's radioactive. Usually at the entrance to the facility, there are radiation detectors to make sure that there's nothing radioactive in the trash. There's a lot of medicines that are radioactive, and if people dispose of them improperly and put them in the trash, it'll go off, and you'll find a 17-ton truck full of trash, and they'll find a little pill with some radioactive iodine in it, or some other type of medication, and it'll light off the sensors, and that truck can't come into the facility. We certainly encourage people to remove mercury-containing items. We don't want thermometers, the thermostats. We encourage people to recycle their electronic waste. There are certainly those things can be handled by the emission control system, and if a mercury thermometer went to a waste energy plant, there will be the emission control will not get all of it. There will be some that comes out. It'll certainly be within the limits of the permit. It'll certainly be within the limits of what EPA and the state consider to be safe for human health and the environment. And frankly, it'll be less of a problem than if that mercury-containing thermometer ended up in the back of a truck and broken in a landfill where it's eventually going to hit the groundwater. In that respect, there's certain things that we'd like to see not come into the facilities, but the trash is not sorted prior to going into the combustion chamber. What you generally put on the curb and it gets collected by the trash truck is what will come to the facility.
Oh, thank you, sir, Mr. Chairman. It's not a follow-up question, but I guess I'd ask is that, do we have anybody from the Department of Environmental Conservation online or available to us? We've got a question about air quality, water quality impacts of this, and just what they think of it. That's our environmental quality people in Alaska. Peterson?
As far as I know, we don't have anybody online here. Representative Peterson, do you have anybody online?
Representative Sador, through the chair, the emissions from these machines have been improved to the point where it meets the EPA standards, and so I don't foresee that the Alaskan standards would be any higher than the EPA standards, not that I'm aware of.
As a follow-up to Representative Sadler's question, that was actually part of my question, was maybe being able to hear from DEC in terms of just the permitting and what the standards are, but also do we have the capability to screen out, you know, like if you get into some of these areas, what are the issues involved, I guess, in terms of keeping hazardous wastes out of the burning? I don't know if you can speak to that. It'd be kind of nice if we had DEC here, I guess. But
Chairman Foster, if, say, for example, they had went to full curbside recycling in Anchorage where they were separating out, you know, glass and metals and those type of things, there would be much less of a problem with, you know, throwing things into the incinerator that might cause, you know, a certain kind of air pollution. And if you did have a incinerator, a waste energy incinerator, that might encourage citizens to go to curbside recycling.
Is there a follow-up, Representative Sadler?
I appreciate the chair's indulgence in this. Growing up, we had an incinerator on the farm. We used to burn garbage, you know, we used to take it down every Saturday. When did we get away from incinerating garbage as a municipal solution, generally in the United States?
Because I've got donuts.
Talk a little fashion.
I like donuts.
Donut holes will work fine.
I love donuts. So my question is, when did we abandon the practice of burning, you know, city municipal waste in general?
Through the chair, Representative Sadler, I don't know an exact date for you, but I believe that, I mean, when they went to you know, EPA and national regulation of air quality, that's when, you know, regulation of, you know, burning waste and regulation of, you know, air qualities and municipalities in general began. And to address the point about a water quality, I don't know the specifics about the permitting necessary to have a landfill, but as Mr. Michaels described, the waste products, you know, the ash created at the end of the combustion process does have to go into a landfill, and so that landfill is going to have gone through all of the necessary permitting processes to make sure that, you know, it doesn't have the water, you know, the weight, the chemical seeping out into the water table.
I'd like to follow up on that question as well, if I may.
Michaels, go ahead.
Representative, you had asked when we stopped incineration. Did you mean in Alaska, or did you mean in the country?
Through the chair, Mr. Michaels, just kind of as a general attack, because this kind of seems like the you know, the second coming or incineration revisited. So just kind of nationally, I guess.
Yeah, I would say that. Well, the oldest operating waste energy facility in the country today started in 1975. And that, you know, I would categorize that as part of the new generation of waste energy facilities. Prior to that, you had what many would actually just call incinerators, where you burn the trash merely to shrink the volume of it. You didn't have energy recovery or energy generation, and you rarely had emissions controls. Starting in 1975, you certainly had more emission controls. The facilities were subject to permits and air quality concerns, and air quality standards, I should say. Now, in 1990, the U.S. Congress amended the Clean Air Act
and made municipal waste combustors subject to these maximum achievable control technology standards. So they enhanced the level of controls that were applicable to waste energy facilities. And that was in 1990. It took EPA a few years, as it does, to get the regulations out, and then the facilities started complying with those new stringent regulations at the end of the 90s. So from 1975 to about 1995, we saw most of the 86 waste energy facilities in the country today built. In the mid-90s, they stopped building waste energy facilities, largely because landfills became extraordinarily cheap and the price of energy was extraordinarily low. So it became very hard for these facilities to compete with landfills. Now, starting in about 5 years ago, that started to change. The economics of landfilling became a little more difficult. Every time you close a landfill, the next one opens up a little farther away. The high price of diesel fuel has gone up and up, making landfilling more expensive. And the price that we are getting for our electricity and the metals that are recovered at the end of the combustion process have made the revenues for waste energy go up a little higher, which allows you to bring your waste prices down to be more competitive with landfills. I think that's why we're seeing what you might consider a resurgence of interest in waste energy these days, especially given the desire across the country to reduce dependence on fossil fuels and to get as much energy as possible from other sustainable alternative sources.
Okay. I appreciate that. I guess comment/question too. I earlier tried to get to this with my question about the cost and about the scalable size of these things. Of course, Alaska has many small rural populations, villages. I'm trying to see if this technology might be useful. You said that the smallest workable is about 70 tons per day. Was that correct?
That was what I said. That's the smallest that's operating in the U.S. Commercially these days. I will say there are a number of companies that are developing technologies on a smaller scale. Representative Peterson had mentioned somewhere that military is looking at smaller scale applications. What I've been describing is what's in place today are larger commercial municipal scale waste energy facilities. I think some of these new technologies really have the capacity to scale to a smaller size, and they're going to find, I think, success in the smaller communities around the country. But when you look at where the waste energy plants are, they're largely in more densely populated areas where it's harder to site a landfill and there's a higher volume of trash. Probably one of the more rural areas in which there's a waste energy facility located is in Tulsa, Oklahoma. The price of landfilling in Tulsa, Oklahoma is only about $15 a ton. The price of the waste energy plant is about $25 a ton, but it was important to the city to get energy from the waste and use it as an energy source and to manage the waste sustainably. And I think some of these new companies with the technologies that are going to be a good fit for smaller communities, and there's some interesting developments on that scale.
One last question that I will abandon.
Oh, absolutely.
Mr. Michaels, I appreciate the dialogue. When the commercial development members of the council make their pitch to communities like in Alaska or any place, in Tulsa, any place, is the primary pitch that this is a power generation technology or a waste management technology? Or both?
I describe it actually as a waste management technology that has that one of its significant perks is the energy generation, because primarily we don't go out, for instance, the 3,000 ton per day waste energy facility, the largest waste energy facility, has an energy baseload electric capacity of about 80 megawatts. And when you compare that to a large coal-fired power plant where it could be 750 or 1,200 megawatts, it's relatively small, because the primary purpose is not to generate electricity; it's to dispose of the waste. The energy is a big bonus, but it is certainly, in my estimate, a secondary option for it's primarily a waste disposal unit. And so when these it's interesting. You had mentioned that when the companies go into communities to make a pitch, oftentimes, I'd say in about half of the facilities that operate in the country, it's the local government that will make the decision that they would prefer to use waste energy instead of landfilling, and then they'll put out a request for proposals to private companies to design, build, and operate a facility for them. So oftentimes, it works in both directions. Sometimes a company will go into a community and say, we're going to build a plant and we'd like to take your waste for a certain price. And other times it's a community that says, we want to make a decision to be sustainable, to manage our waste sustainably, to create some energy that we can use right where we generate it. And we'd like you to come in and operate the facility for us.
Thank you, Mr. Michaels. Representative Peterson?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I was just going to make one additional point. Mr. Michaels mentioned the first facility opened in 1975. That was actually in Ames, Iowa. And I was actually living in Ames, Iowa at the time. And I remember when watching and hearing on the news, and they were talking about developing this plant that was going to burn garbage to generate electricity. And so this plant has been operating this entire time. And as a matter of fact, I was reminded about that one day after a Transportation Committee meeting when the Transportation Commissioner Mark Lucan and I were talking, and he mentioned that he was born and raised in Ames, Iowa, and then brought up the fact that they had been using their garbage to generate electricity there for several decades, and that's sort of jogged my memory, and that's where I sort of came up with the idea to write this resolution.
Thank you, Representative Peterson. I'm inclined to want to hear from DEC. I see that copies of the resolution was sent out to Denali Commission and the AEA. Was just curious if you'd gotten any feedback, and then also, I think more importantly, I'm interested in whether or not AML has taken a stance on this. I Kathy Wasserman, I think, was here this morning with the Alaska Municipal League, and just curious, I guess, on those issues. Have they taken a stance on this, AML?
Not to my knowledge.
Yeah, I definitely would encourage also, since we're encouraging both the state, municipality, and I see also we have private organizations, and kind of hearing the testimony, we hear that this is very much a waste management tool. I probably want to hear from kind of the thoughts of waste management themselves, or Alaska Waste, whatever our local company is, and even the SWS, kind of get their thoughts on this, because if we're going to encourage them as a legislature, definitely want to hear from them on their thoughts. Can we do this here? Should we be encouraging something that they can or can't be a part of? So I would kind of voice that as well. I definitely want to hear from them. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Certainly support the concept. I don't know if it's the wishes of the committee to want to hear more or to move it out. I guess some general feedback here. Representative Tuck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This resolution encourages, we're not passing a bill that mandates it, and I think that if we're passing a bill that mandates that, we definitely want to make sure we get all the details on it. I'm sure that any plant that's going to be built in the state of Alaska is going to have to make sure it meets all of DEC's, everybody else's requirements, emissions controls, and everything else. It was interesting to read through some of these states. And I flipped through some of these states to see how large of units there are and what year they're put together. A lot of these are the mid-1980s and still going. You can see when they added new units. I appreciate some of the comments that are written in here. I tagged a couple of them just as we've been talking. One of them says, this is Chief Waste Minimization Branch, Office of Solid Waste and Emergency Response, U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, EPA, waste to energy is turning a problem into an energy solution. And we do have the document that shows EPA's comments on waste to energy. They have a white paper on that. I think that's the second page of our information. And then another quote here from Union County, New Jersey Utilities Authority, waste to energy is a probably one of the greatest stories never told. We take regular household garbage and use it as a fuel, burn it into a boiler to create electricity. And there's just anecdotal stuff all through that, which I thought was really interesting. But I was looking at mainly to see how old some of these plants were and how much trash that they're doing annually. And it's quite remarkable flipping through this. Just to respond to a couple of questions that I heard earlier, just looking at the Wikipedia document, if I can find it fast enough, there is talking about the efficiency and how the waste that's coming out of this is less waste than what people are burning in their wood stoves. I guess that's how efficient they are. And I don't remember off the top of my head, but I think the electricity generation is about 18 to 24%, is what you would see in a coal plant anyway because of the energy and steam. So just a few comments on that. Interesting read.
And one additional point about this being a renewable form of energy, once you generate enough electricity and sell it to the grid, you could pay off the cost of the facility, and then obviously your cost of producing electricity would be reduced significantly, and that's why some of the facilities that have been in existence for a number of years have already paid off their original debt and are probably producing electricity for a couple, 3 cents a kilowatt hour.
Representative Sadler?
Thank you. Just a comment. Yeah, I'm also, this is intriguing. There's some possibilities here, but it would be good to hear from what AML, I had that same thought, because I saw Kathy Wasserman earlier today. I thought, I wonder what they think about this. And AEA, it would be nice to have them weigh in as well. So I can see the merits, but I'd like to know a little bit more about it if I could.
I think we'll go ahead and hold it over. I think if we could just get that little bit of extra work and hear from them. I know it's not binding, but at the same time, just to make sure that we're making sure that everybody's on board. So we'll go ahead and hold it over. Chris, Representative Tutt.
Yeah, one quick question. I don't know if Ted Michaels can answer this question, but does these technologies, are they able to take advantage of the tax credits for construction underneath any federal programs?
Yes, sir. If the facilities are owned by a taxpayer, if the facility is owned by the local government, then the local government, as a tax-exempt entity, would not be able to take advantage of the tax credit. But if it's owned by a taxpayer, then it's eligible for a Section 45 Renewable Energy Production Tax Credit. Currently, the window for that is open until December 31st, 2013. If the facility is built and placed in service before that date, then they would be eligible for a 1.1 cent per kilowatt hour tax credit for a period of 10 years.
Thank you.
Just clarify, that's if it's owned by a taxpayer, like a private individual or a corporation or something. But like
exactly.
MLMP, a local or a municipal power generating utility, would not qualify for that?
Yeah, yes, sir.
Okay, good.
You're correct.
Thanks.
Well, if we could get that additional information, we'll hold that over. We do have an update here that we've got another presentation here. An update on energy efficiency policy by Dr. John Davies, recovering legislator and senior researcher with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center. Welcome, Mr. Davies. I do want to point out I had a nice conversation with Mr. Davies and learned that he served with my father on the Finance Committee years ago, so it was very nice to hear some stories there. I appreciate that. If you could, please identify yourself for the record and proceed.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is John Davies. I'm a senior researcher with the Cold Climate Housing Research Center in Fairbanks, Alaska. And with your permission, I'd like to go ahead and give you this update. What I'm presenting to you today is a kind of an interim report or a progress report on some work that we're doing funded through AEA with a grant from the Department of Energy. And the task that we're trying to do is to take a look at the report that we issued in 2008 on energy efficiency policy for the state of Alaska. And we're in the process of reviewing that, updating that, and expanding it. The expansion will be mainly into areas of electrical use, transportation, and industrial use that weren't covered in the original report. So we're hoping to have a much more comprehensive energy efficiency policy report available for the legislature by the end of this calendar year, so by December we'll have that for you. But today I'm giving you the results from an interim evaluation, mostly from a one-day workshop that we held in Anchorage on March 2nd, and to give you these ideas now so that you can be thinking about them over the interim and perhaps converting some of them into potential legislation. So with that, I'll get started here. I'll work through this. The interim report is in draft form right now, and so I haven't submitted it to anyone yet. It'll be out in a week or so, and as soon as it's available, it's gone through the final edits from the various agencies, then I'll make it available to everyone here. So, and you do have the printouts from my PowerPoint presentation here. So I'm certainly be willing to provide additional information if you're interested in that, and certainly more as we go along. But so the scope, again, is to take a look at the 2008 report to see how well we've done with that, and then to look ahead to what and to talk about what the significance of energy efficiency is, considering it as a resource. I know that Representative Sadler has seen this before, so absolutely. So the 2008 report, again, was funded by the Energy Authority and the Housing Finance Corporation, and it was staffed by Information Insights. Energy efficiency is something that's sometimes referred to as the low-hanging fruit, something that we can do right now. It's not huddling in a cold room with a sweater on, but rather doing the same, providing the same results with less. So it's having the same amount of heat with less fuel, or the same amount of light with less electricity. It relies on advancing technologies, which are becoming more plentiful, or technologies advancing all the time, rather than fossil fuels, which in many cases are becoming depleted or much more expensive. It's often the case, almost always in fact, that saving energy is much less expensive than buying it. So if we can avoid having to buy it, we're better off. And of course, if we don't burn something, then there's less pollution and less CO2 production. The 2008 report had 23 individual policy recommendations that were presented in these 9 categories. I'm going to go through those fairly briefly in the form of a spreadsheet that I'm going to show you and give you a kind of a subjective evaluation of how well we've done on each one of those, and give you an overall report card on where we are. And then I'll talk about some of the other ideas. So since the 2008, we've had Senate Bill 289 and 330 in 2008, which expanded the weatherization program and created the new energy efficiency rebate program. We also, in 2010, had House Bill 306, which established a state energy policy, established legislative intent for the state of Alaska, provided us a good direction finder where we're headed, and is a very good piece of visioning for the state of Alaska. One of the things that it points out is that supply and demand for fossil fuels and concerns about climate change will affect the price of fossil fuels in Alaska and the price that we get when we export those from the state to other markets. The vision statement covers energy efficiency and conservation. It covers the economic development that we can achieve by considering renewable energy and alternative energies. It talks about the need for energy research, education, and workforce development. And it talked about providing these things with streamlined governmental programs. Then there was Senate Bill 220 that was passed in last year, 2010, the Sustainable Energy Act. And it created a number of funds that helped to advance the cause, Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund, which deals with public buildings, the Southeast Energy Fund, which were grants for energy projects, the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, which are grants for demonstration projects, the Alternative Energy Conservation Revolving Loan Fund, which is an alternative fund looking at energy conservation improvements in public buildings and some private buildings, incidentally. And then an improvement to the old LIHEAP program, now called the Alaska Affordable Heating Program, which expanded eligibility and added more funding to that program. There were a number of other things we talked about, getting a database from public facilities, improving efficiency in the use of public vehicles where that was practical, some considerations about nuclear power and when that might be considered alternative power. It called for an increase in public education, public outreach. And then it provided a number of tools for municipalities and the agencies to encourage the use of renewable and alternative energy. So looking at those things, then we want to evaluate the scope of this. What we're going to do today is take a look at how that compares to what we talked about in the 2008 report. And then, like I said, in December, we'll have a much expanded report available to you. The report will also try to cover in more detail than the original report or this presentation today issues around the whole state. So we're going to try to look at more specifically at some rural issues, some of the urban issues, southeast, rail belt, coastal, interior, north slope. In other words, try to get a very comprehensive view across the whole energy efficiency landscape for the entire state of Alaska. So let's see how well we've done in these. Again, there are nine categories. One was state leadership, and I won't go through this whole thing in detail, but I'll do the first one just so you get the idea of how it's the table's laid out. We called for two things under state leadership. There was a recommendation that related to government vision provided by the governor, and also a sub-cabinet focus on energy efficiency, a kind of a above the silos of individual agencies focus for this kind of effort. And while the governor didn't provide this kind of vision in a comprehensive way, House Bill 306 did. And the work that was done by the House last year really, I think, established a substantive and correct vision for the state of Alaska related to a lot of energy issues, including energy efficiency. And so under the percent done column there, I gave us a 90% for having established a good vision to work from. However, on the issue of providing a focus, not much was done. I gave us about a 10% there, and altogether it gave us an overall value for this category of 60%. And again, these are kind of subjective evaluations, but just to give us a guidance about kind of where things are going. Then over in the last column where it says goals, there's a G there. And that means that's something that is still a goal. It means something that we still need to be working on. If there's a dollar sign there, it means, of course, that there's some need for continuing funding in that area. So under funding, the second category, funding energy efficiency, again, about 60% complete on those four recommendations. On the public education outreach, about 30% done. There's a fair amount of work going on, but it's not with existing funds. It's not a particularly specifically funded program, and it still remains, I think, a large need to really get out the information to a large number of our citizens. Even though everybody's kind of got the message that energy is expensive, you would be surprised how many people are just unaware that the rebate program even exists. So there's a lot of work to do just to make people aware of that. Baseline data is another one of these things. If we want to be able to understand what we need to do, we need to know what we are doing now, what we're not doing, and we have to have a way to measure our progress. So establishing the baseline data, how much energy are individual buildings using, how much energy is going into fast food restaurants, how much energy in residences and big box stores. We don't have good data for the state of Alaska on those kinds of on all of those kinds of buildings. So there is an effort under AEA. It needs to be continued, but we're making good progress there. So I gave us an 80% on that one. Existing residential buildings, of course, this is where the weatherization and the rebate program made a big impact. For those two areas, I gave ourselves 100%, even though there's a need to keep going. I would point out that even with the substantial amount of funding that was provided through the appropriations from Senate Bill 330 and the supplemental in 2008. If all of that money were spent, it's all encumbered now, but when it's all spent, we still will only have impacted somewhere around 10% of the homes in the state of Alaska. So there's more to be done. I gave ourselves an 80% for that category. New residential buildings. The biggest need here, which keeps coming back, is the need for a statewide energy efficiency code, a standard, if you will, that applies across the state, different for different regions, different energy intensity regions, but a code that says this is the minimum standard, so we don't continue to build buildings that we're going to have to fix 10 years from now. We need to make sure that there's kind of a level playing field. Everything that's funded through HFC meets the BEES, the Building Energy Efficiency Standard. It would be a good thing for the state of Alaska, we believe, that all financing agencies that finance residential construction in the state met that same energy standard. It would be good for the people who are buying the buildings, too. Incidentally, it'd be cheaper to run them. So I gave us as a 30% there. Existing commercial buildings, same kinds of issues for commercial buildings that apply to residential buildings, and we've done less there, so 20%. New commercial buildings, HFC has through Senate Bill 220, established the public building revolving loan fund. There's a kind of a commercial buildings in code means non-residential, really. So there's kind of an ambiguity here about commercial versus public, and they aren't necessarily different. But we had talked about AEA developing a commercial energy code. That was the goal here. HFC actually did that, and in the context of the public building revolving loan fund. And so I gave ourselves an 80% because we've established that energy standard. And then in the case of public buildings, there is the HFC revolving loan fund, that the bottom line there, E, the triple F. It's kind of like a travel guide. You know, if you see where, you know, in Frommer's guide or something like that, they say, you know, it's $1 for things that are kind of okay and $2 for things that are kind of spendy and $3 if they're really expensive. Well, this is kind of the same thing. If there's three Fs, that means that there's a funding program that's available that can provide a fair amount of money. So for that AHFC program that came out of Senate Bill 220, I gave ourselves 100%. But overall, in dealing with public buildings, we still have there are things to do, so about a 90% there. Altogether, if you average these up, these nine categories, we're at about 59 to 60%. So we've done a pretty good job. We've put in place policies that are programs that deal with about 60% of the policy recommendations that were in that 2008 report. So I'd say that's pretty good. But there's obviously things to do. And so the working group that met March 2nd considered that, and these are the, and I apologize, there's a typo in this slide that should be 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5, although when the bullets got reformatted, I didn't notice that the numbers got changed. So the top recommendation, again, out of the working group was for a statewide energy efficiency code or standard, and I'd already discussed that. The second recommendation in priority ranking was to sustainably fund the weatherization and rebate programs. I just mentioned a minute ago if the present funding that we do, once it's all expended, we will get to about 10% of the housing. About 20, maybe as much as 28,000 homes. There's 280,000 households in the state of Alaska. So if we were to get to a substantial majority of that, we have a long ways to go. Education, outreach, training, and kindergarten through university courses. So there's a need for public outreach to help people understand what they can do. There's a need to train the workers that are going to deliver these services. And also, it's always good to start in the schools with educating people about the value of energy efficiency. The fourth one is utilities-based end-use electrical energy efficiency programs. What that is kind of a mouthful, but what it means is that RCA should work with our utilities like MEA or GVA to help incentivize the ratepayers, the customers, in installing more energy-efficient lighting, appliances, and other things that use electricity in their homes, pumps, fans, that sort of thing. Technology is working for us. There's new motors that are about three times as efficient. That is, they use a third as much energy as the older motors for fans and that kind of thing. And of course, you all know that the compact fluorescent and the new T8 bulbs instead of the T9 fluorescent tubes are much more energy efficient, deliver much more light, same amount of light for much less energy. So with the assistance from RCA and helping to craft these programs and the utilities helping to deliver them, we can get fairly substantial, again, 30 to 50% energy savings in the electrical realm as well. And we've started, some utilities do more than others, but there's a lot more to be done there. And these are oftentimes the things that pay back the most. There's a building owner in Fairbanks that I know of who replaced all the old 4-foot fluorescent tubes, the T12s with T8s in his building. Cost him $9,000 to relamp the whole building. He saved that amount of money in the first year. So 100% payback. That's show me any other investment where you can get that return on your money. So there's lots of opportunity to make those kinds of savings. And lastly, the fifth top recommendation is to legislate efficiency as a priority. And what we mean by this is that before we start sizing any kind of a power plant, a renewable plant, alternative energy, conventional fossil fuel plant, if we're providing public money for that, we ought to require the people that are putting that plant, that design and that plan together, to consider reducing the demand side first before they size the power plant. Because oftentimes when you do that, you can significantly reduce the size of the power plant. And I'll give you a simple example of that, too, in Fairbanks on the airport when they were looking at that. There's a fair amount of glass in the airport. They spec'd fairly high-quality triple-pane window glass for that building, and that was fairly expensive. So rightly so, the owner representative said, can we use less expensive glass? If they reduce the cost of that glass, they could do that. If they did that, however, they had to increase the size of the ducts to provide more heating and cooling. And the first cost of providing that additional HVAC work, the ducts and the fans, was three times as expensive as the cost of the glass. So you could save $1 million by going to cheaper glass, but it's going to cost you $3 million in increased HVAC system. So that's just not an operating cost. That was just in first cost savings. So oftentimes by considering these things together, we can get a much better bang for the buck if we do that at the outset and in an integrated fashion. So we think that it would be a good idea for the legislature to look at that as a policy for the state of Alaska, that when we design these projects, that we do that sort of integrated design process. Now we have a number of recommendations here, and with Mr. Chairman, with the time constraints, I'm not going to read through every one of these. I'm going to just leaf through this and leave it to you to look at them and ask you to consider them, each of those. And if you have further questions, I'm happy to answer them. But this is an interim report. These are suggestions for you to consider that you might want to consider for legislation that you may be working on. So there's some elements of state leadership. The Energy Code, for example, is in here. The RCA issues are in here. And the legislation of efficiency is, requiring that as a state policy. Education, training, and outreach, we talked about some of the issues there, workforce training. One of these things I'll mention, you might consider establishing a green schools caucus here in the legislature, for example. Residential buildings. We really need to continue to fund the home energy rebate and weatherization program, and I'll talk a little bit more about that at the end here. But one of the concerns that came out of this working group is that because we've only scratched the surface, as it were, on this, that it would be really good if we could figure out some way to sustainably fund these programs so we could continue to get through a larger fraction of the building stock in the state of Alaska. And there's recommendations here relating to commercial buildings, to public buildings, to the community and regional planning. What kind of outreach can we do as state leaders in helping communities deal with these kinds of issues? I'm going to spend a little bit of time on this slide. This is talking about how big is the energy efficiency resource. I'm just going to use the home energy rebate program as an example here, because we have some data now. It's been in existence for a while. We've completed about 10,000 homes, and the numbers that I'm going to talk to you here are based on those, on the results from those 10,000, and the fact that we've seen that on average we're saving about 30% of energy in those homes. And we've also verified that in a subset of those, about 1,000 homes in Anchorage in the NSTAR district, where we've looked at the actual bills before and after and verified that what we're predicting from the program and the software that we use to analyze it, we're within 3% of whatever. With that program says we're going to save 25%, we're within 3% in that projection based on actual bills from that study in Anchorage. So what we're looking at here, this is the green line is what I'm calling the annual energy efficiency savings. So this is how much energy we're saving after one year, 5 years, 10 years of this program being in effect, assuming that we're spending money at about the rate that we're spending right now. So right now, with the existing funding in place, for the last couple of years, we've been spending on this program something on the order of $125 million a year. If we were to continue that for 5 or 10 years into the future, you can see that at about 7 years, we cross the red dashed line there. The red dashed line represents the amount of energy required to provide electricity at the peak for the Anchorage Load Center. So that's all of the Anchorage area, South Central Alaska, excluding Mat-Su. That's a fair amount of energy. It's about 12 trillion BTUs per hour. So, or per year, I'm sorry, per year. It's an annual basis. If we go on for about 12 years, you can see that the green line crosses the blue dashed line. That represents the amount of energy that we spend on an annual basis. In fact, that's how much we spent in 2010, consumed, actually, for natural gas in all of Alaska. Of course, that's mostly South Central. That's Mat-Su. It's the entire gas network in the South Central area. So these are fairly large numbers. I just wanted to give you those things to compare. How could we do that? How could we sustain that funding? Well, one way we could do it was through some kind of an endowment. And just thinking in general terms, if you set aside $4.5 billion in an endowment, and you could expect a 3% annual return on that investment, which is a fairly modest expectation, that fund would generate about $135 million a year, so about the kind of money that's required to generate this green line in energy savings. And so basically what you do after some period of time in spending this kind of money is you've, in effect, created a power plant that creates that level of energy with no operations, no operational cost, because it's a savings that results year in and year out once you've established that level of energy efficiency. So it compares in magnitude with the largest projects that we've talked about doing. The Anchorage Load Center, for example, this 12 trillion BTUs is the output of equivalently something like a 320 megawatt power plant. I think that the message here is that we should think of energy efficiency as a very significant resource, and that we should talk about it in the same way that we talk about other major projects. So in conclusion, I think it's imperative that we use our present wealth to develop an economy that's much less reliant on fossil fuels to assure a healthy and sustainable future. As Mr. Chairman, as you know, many of our smaller communities are simply not sustainable at the high cost of energy that we have right now. And this is one way that we can begin to address that problem. even in my town in Fairbanks, we're concerned that Fairbanks may not be sustainable if we have to continue to spend the amount that we do on energy right now. One of the most cost-effective resources we have to deal with that problem is energy efficiency and conservation. Further, the sustained energy and cost savings to businesses and homeowners from energy efficiency will result in reinvestment in Alaska's economy. The money that we don't spend that goes out of state to provide this kind of the current conventional energy systems will stay in our state and in our communities, and will stimulate jobs there, continuing jobs, and substantial economic growth. The bottom line is that a sustained investment over in energy efficiency will foster a much more sustainable and a vibrant economy for many years to come. So thank you, Mr. Chairman. I appreciate your having me down here to talk about this, and I'm open for questions.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. I had a question. You'd mentioned the Green Schools Caucus, and I had actually gone to a Green Schools training program in the last 6 or 12 months,
mm-hmm.
and I think for a lot of folks that hear the word green, everyone's got a different interpretation of
right.
what that means. And for me, when I got there, it was just simply, how can we make, for example, schools for students more energy efficient and make them better places for children to learn? But so they've actually inquired here within the legislature whether or not there might be some interest in creating just such a caucus. And can you maybe just elaborate a little more on what a Green Schools Caucus could be, or just the concept of a Green Schools? And
well, I think you've got the basic idea is to help design schools that are much more sustainable. They use less energy. They have less what's called an ecological impact. So they're designed in a way that they provide energy more efficiently, but more important, and also that they use energy that is clean. Cleaner energy, so using, for example, natural gas instead of oil, or using wind energy or solar PV energy instead of natural gas, going one step cleaner and cleaner in terms of its impact on the environment. Things like wind energy and photovoltaic energy and solar thermal energy have no pollution attached to them, or very little direct pollution anyway, so that the environment around the school is much, much cleaner, has better air quality for the kids. But beyond that, it also considers the construction techniques. What kinds of materials are you using to construct the schools? Are you using plywoods that have formaldehydes in them, so that when the kids are inside the building, that they're breathing unknown carcinogen? That's not a good thing. And we now have building materials that have low or no, what are called VOCs, volatile organic compounds, VOCs. So we want to design the schools so that they're healthy environments. We need to design them with good ventilation systems that not only provide fresh air but also filter air. In Fairbanks in the summertime, we have forest fires. We can put filters on the air intakes on the schools so that when the kids are in the buildings, the air in there is much cleaner than outside. 75%, or let's say in the middle of a forest fire, we can reduce the amount of particulates in the building to 25% what it is outside with a very easy filter system. So just that kind of thing. In the design, also in the design of the construction process, minimizing the footprint, making it close to public transportation so that kids have alternative ways to get to school, making sure that the school is designed to minimize the use of water, so that we make effective use of that resource. There are a lot of different issues around making it so-called green, and what it green really means to make it a healthier place and a much more sustainable place that is economically sustainable on into the future.
Thank you, Mr. Davies. Are there any other questions of the committee?
Yeah, no question.
Representative Pruitt.
You had mentioned the need for universal energy rating system.
Mm-hmm.
Do you guys utilize the ACWARM right now?
Yes, we do.
Okay.
And that would be, is that the preferred one that you guys use, or do you use other?
There are many pieces of software that have been written. Some are easier to use than others. And the main advantage of ACWARM, which is developed by here in the state of Alaska by generations of agencies, principally now AHSC, but even before AHSC took it over. The main advantage of the ACWARM software is that it's easy to use, so that it doesn't require a PhD to use it. It doesn't require 3 months of work to do the analysis on one building. I actually trained myself to use it in about an hour by myself. That's how relatively straightforward it is. It's fairly accurate. The gold standard, if you will, of these kinds of softwares is one that's developed by the Department of Energy. It's called DOE-2. We've actually done a benchmark comparison between ACWARM and DOE-2 by a third-party contractor to come in and run 200 different building configurations using both softwares and compare the two programs within 5% of each other in their predictions of energy consumption. So they do a pretty good job. The ACWARM is limited in the sense that it's really designed for residential use. It doesn't work very well for, it'll do well for a simple, small commercial building, but if you get into something much more complicated, especially things like food service, places that have kitchens and that kind of thing, then it's not designed to do that, and it doesn't deal with those well. However, I have to say that we are in the process right now of working on upgrading it so that they're is a kind of a beta version of a commercial version of ACWARM out right now, and shortly it'll be able to handle kind of medium complex commercial buildings. It'll never be the thing that you'd want to do if you were building a 10-story skyscraper or something like that. You'd want to contract with a much more sophisticated program. The more sophisticated programs do what are called hourly simulations, so they calculate the energy inputs and outputs every hour throughout the whole year to analyze a building. ACWARM just uses an algorithm to do that. It doesn't have to do that calculation for every hour. It just does one simple calculation. But it does it very well for what it's designed. That may be more than you wanted to know.
That's a great follow-through. So you guys are actually very involved with developing the additional commercial aspect of...
Right. We are. Cold Climate Housing Research Center is a contractor working for AHFC. In developing and advancing ACWARM.
So would that be a program that you would feel or you could get behind as being part of that universal rating system that you were talking about, potentially utilizing it as the kind of the main program for the state? And I'm going to caveat. I'll tell you why I'm asking it in a minute.
Okay. I want to make sure I understand what your question is. Are you talking about the energy code that I talked about, the energy efficiency code for the state of Alaska?
Yeah, utilizing it.
Right. ACWARM is a tool that would be involved in that, but it's not the whole picture, I guess. I want to make sure that I'm clear on answering your question there. Certainly it would be a tool that would be used in that, but the idea of it's an energy efficiency standard is just something that says that when you design a building, it should meet certain standards, and you can provide that standard in two fundamental ways. One is you can do it prescriptively, which says that walls need to be this R value, windows need to be this R value, floor systems, energy delivery systems. You specify each of those individually as a prescriptive list, or you can say on a performance basis, you can say this building needs to be 30% less energy than a standard building, and you get there by using ACWARM. That's how you find out whether it is or not. You model both buildings and look at the energy outputs.
All right, thank you.
Well, thank you so much. We're out of time here, but we appreciate your coming here and keeping us informed, and wish you a good trip back to Fairbanks. There, that wraps up today's hearing, and we will not be meeting on Thursday, April 7. There is no further business today to come before us, Therefore, this meeting is adjourned at 4:32 p.m. Thank you, everybody.
Thank you.